From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, as the state looks back at the Enbridge oil spill, a Michigan man remembers cleaning up one of the worst oil spills ever, the Exxon Valdez.
It was pretty gruesome. You had otter, birds, and the like.
Why Coleman Young deserves to be on a new list of Detroit's best mayors.
A close friend of his has always said to me that what people don't understand when they talk about Coleman Young was that being pro-black was not anti-white.
Political parties getting sneaky to check out the competition.
If you're a candidate, assume that anything that you say to even a small group of people is going to be, could be made public.
And stand-up paddling, it's how more of us are enjoying Michigan's waters. Those stories and more today on Stateside. Demolish or restore? Blight is one of Detroit's biggest problems. Should we tear down and start afresh, or look at buildings, see what can be preserved? I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's Stateside, we'll ask, is Detroit's approach to blight the best plan for the city? What happens when we tear down history? But first, the fight over the state's minimum wage continues. You recall in May, Governor Snyder signed an increase to the state's minimum wage law, but his signature was apparently not the final word. Chris Gouts is Capitol correspondent for Crain's Detroit Business. What's happening this week at the Capitol about minimum wage?
Well, we're going to see the next fight brewing on Thursday. There'll be the Board of State Canvassers will meet to decide possibly whether or not this ballot measure has enough sufficient signatures to make it onto the ballot. So that's the next step, and it'll almost certainly be immediately followed by a court fight, no matter what the outcome is.
Give us the argument that those in favor of allowing this proposal that would let us decide whether to raise the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. That's the Raise Michigan proposal. What argument are they plan to use to push for this? Because now there's a new law in place.
Right. I mean, their argument is pretty much what you just said, is that the people should have the right to decide, that they're tired of the Republican tactics of circumventing the will of the people, in their words, that this is something that they wanted to put on the ballot, and they got the signatures, and they did it the right way that they believe, and so this should be a very simple thing, that it should go on the ballot, and voters should have a choice whether or not to raise the minimum wage or not, regardless of the end around that they feel that the legislature and the governor did, that this is an issue that that they did the right way, and voters should have a chance to do it in November.
And the opposition argument?
That argument is that this raises way too much, way too fast, and there was a very bipartisan law that was passed and signed by the governor that was supported by also by Mark Schauer, the Democratic candidate for governor, that said, you know, this is the way to go, and we should support this law, and they've kind of left off, the Raise Michigan folks, so they're sort of on their own, sort of on an island, trying to still fight the good fight in their belief, but the opponents say that, you know, we've signed this law, we've repealed the old one, and that means that your ballot proposal is moot because you're trying to fix a law that's no longer exists.
As you point out in your piece for Crain's, Chris, the attorneys who filed against allowing this proposal on the full ballot filed on behalf of a group called People Protecting Michigan Jobs. Tell us, when was that group formed, and where's it headquartered?
Well, it's headquartered at the office of the Michigan Restaurant Association, which was very much opposed to the ballot initiative, one, because of just the regular increase in the minimum wage, but also because what's not often is talked about is that it would also raise the tipped minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. So that obviously has a huge impact, they feel, on restaurants across the state and in the tourism industry. So they're concerned that restaurants could close or that they would hire fewer workers. So they've been very much opposed to this. And they formed this group, People Protecting Michigan Jobs, on the day that Raise Michigan submitted its signatures to the Department of State. And so it hasn't been around long, but obviously their job is to try to keep this off of the ballot.
Bottom line, what must the State Board of Canvassers decide tomorrow?
Well, that's sort of an open question. I mean, what they could do. Yeah. Obviously, the board is a four-member body of two Democrats and two Republicans. So it's possible, and the Raise Michigan folks believe that all that they are tasked with doing is deciding whether or not there are sufficient signatures, and if so, they must approve it, and then the courts and the two sides can hash it out in the appellate process, and then obviously I would assume this would go all the way to the Supreme Court, and so that's what they could do. They could also, you know, decide to try to take a look at all the signatures, and there's many ways that this could go, but no matter what happens, it's going to go to the courts. One interesting sort of quirk to this is that if the canvassers did decide that it should go ahead and be on the ballot, the Attorney General's office would have to defend the Board of Canvassers in court, and so then you'd have, you know, the Attorney General being in one of those weird spots where he's defending the decision to have this Raise Michigan proposal on the ballot if they decide to do that. So, and there's plenty of quirks like that, and it seems like every turn this thing is going on, and it's not done yet.
Well, you need a roadmap to follow this, that's for sure. We're glad you're doing it. Chris Gouts covers Lansing for Crane's Detroit Business. Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you.
By now, you've probably heard the chuckling, the snickering, and the Democratic growling over that pair of young Republican operatives, the ones who turned up at a Mark Schauer fundraiser at a private home in Bloomfield Hills. One of the pair wore fake glasses with a tiny video camera built into the frame. It all might have gone undetected, but for the fact the memory card of their secret squirrel mission somehow turned up on the floor of a union hall in Farmington Hills 2 weeks later. Democrats immediately posted the 8-minute video wherein we learned little more than the facts that Natalie Collins, the GOP staffer who wore the glasses, doesn't like having her photo taken when she's eating pineapple, and she didn't think too much of the artwork at the home. Democrats cried foul, dirty tricks, and Republicans shrugged and said, well, everyone does it. So, do they? Let's turn to Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta and get some thoughts. So, Zoe, why are Democrats squawking about how horrible this is to tape a candidate at a private event when, oh, remember what happened to Mitt Romney at that private fundraiser when he made the 47% comment that we all learned about?
Right. They are doing this because it's good politics, because this is a great story. We've all been talking about it, and why not get as much coverage about it as possible? You know, we see this all the time in politics where one party does something and the other party is aghast that they would dare do it. And you look back,
clutch
and they've
my pearls.
Most likely done the same thing or will do the same thing, or deep down go, that's a great idea. We're going to use that in the future. And again, Cindy, like you mentioned, the story is just so rich, and the fact that exactly that it was just this sort of bumbling wannabe Mission Impossible story that you just almost feel bad for them. So it's this combination of that it's a great story, and also it was just so sad.
And I can hear you snickering away, Rick Pluta. what would you like to add?
Well, first of all, you know, you'll remember in the last election that one of the ways that Democrats beat Republicans was on the technological front. And so what we found is in this cycle that there is at least one area where Republicans seem to be ahead of the Democrats, and that is in getting cameras in tiny little glasses. but you know, there are comparisons being made here to Watergate. Some Democrats are trying to, you know, make it about darker conspiracies. But really, one of the other comparisons, and perhaps the more apt one, is remember that the Watergate burglars got caught because they were bad at it, that they broke into the Watergate Hotel. They taped the doors. A security guard came by and pulled the tape off. And so the burglars went back and taped them again. Mm-hmm. And that's what tipped them off.
You know, we say, all right, so yeah, both sides are using little secrets. Squirrels to try to catch the other guy in a good gotcha moment. So what?
Right. That's the issue. I mean, it feels, and Rick and I have talked about this, it feels icky. There is a sense that this is unfair. This is dirty politics. But what I keep thinking about, and what I think is important to note, is this sense of, yes, we might not like how they're going about it, but isn't there something about voters being able to hear what candidates are saying when they don't necessarily know that it's going to be made public, that should it be really fair that candidates do feel like that they can say one thing in private and another in public, that should there be that sacred area, that they're allowed to talk at fundraisers and private gatherings and say one thing and then maybe do another to the public. So I'm not necessarily advocating for the idea of tricks in politics, but at the same thing, if the outcome is hearing a stance that politician or that lawmaker isn't willing to make in public, I don't necessarily know if that's a bad thing.
And in fact, Democrats actually have their own operation like this. They call it the Accountability Project. Yep. And it's because they believe that Republicans are going and saying one thing in public, and then their candidates are saying things that are somewhat different when they get behind closed doors. And so really, the only way that this Accountability Project works is if they are actually recording candidates when the candidates believe that they can be candid. And I guess if there's another lesson to be, drawn from this other than, check your pockets for holes, it's if you're a candidate, assume that anything that you say to even a small group of people is going to be could be made public.
Well, and it was not actually a Democratic operative who caught Mitt Romney at that fundraiser. It was somebody working the bar.
Exactly.
Who rolled his camera.
Although he may have had some connections
We don't know for sure. We know it was a bartender. He could have had some kind of connections. But again, it goes to this idea that maybe lawmakers shouldn't feel like they can say one thing somewhere and another thing elsewhere.
Well, and it certainly provided for 8 minutes of pretty hilarious watching.
And every spy joke that you can imagine, that the Michigan Democratic Party has posted videos to YouTube.
Yeah.
And in our segment, we used the James Bond theme and
Secret Agent Man.
The theme from Spies Like Us, and the Democrats are using the theme from the Pink Panther.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of references to Get Smart.
I will say, though, watching this video, you get a little like Blair Witch Project sense from it. I saw one tweet, I think it was Kathy Gray, who tweeted from the Detroit Free Press something about that she needed Dramamine after watching it.
Yes.
You know, that you feel a little dizzy and you feel like, oh gosh, I can't watch this video anymore.
And Neil Rubin from the Detroit News wrote, yep. Well, okay, that's great, but cool, you can get glasses with cameras in them?
Awesome!
Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics team, Zoe Clark, Rick Pluta, as always, thank you so much.
Thanks, Cindy.
Oh, my pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Detroit marks its 313th birthday this week, drawing some extra attention because, of course, the 313 is Detroit's area code. Stateside's partner, the Detroit Free Press, is marking the occasion with a ton of historical pieces, and that includes a look at the 5 worst mayors in Detroit history. Yes, Kwame Kilpatrick and Albert Kobo, we're talking to you. And also the 5 best mayors. On the best list, Coleman Young, mayor of Detroit from 1974 to 1994, Detroit's first black mayor. Throughout Detroit's financial crisis, it's been pretty easy to find those who blame Young for Detroit's ruin. But doesn't that conveniently overlook the decades of poor decisions by mayors who preceded him and those who followed him? Let's take a closer look at Coleman Young's legacy with writer Larry Gabriel. He explored that in a piece for Bridge Magazine. Also, Stephen Henderson, a Detroiter who is the editorial page editor of the Detroit Free Press. Stephen, why do you think Coleman Young's become such a lightning rod for blaming Detroit's bankruptcy?
Well, I mean, I think because he's a lightning rod for everything in Detroit. I mean, he's the single most powerful litmus test, I think, in this area, which has always struck me as odd because, if you go to other cities, Richard J. Daley, the first, was mayor for quite a long time in Chicago. No one's talking about him today. If you go to New York, no one talks about Ed Koch or the great mayors of their past. I mean, they don't frame the narratives for the current political conversation. Yet here in Detroit, we are now 20 years since Coleman Young was mayor here, almost 20 years since his death, and you cannot get a bigger reaction out of somebody by saying any other name than his. I mean, he is the sort of beginning and end of all political discussion in the city still, which I think is unfortunate. That says a lot about our community. It says a lot about race, I think, and how we perceive race and racial firsts. But that's the reason he's the lightning rod in the bankruptcy, is because he is the lightning rod for everything around here.
And Larry Gabriel, in your column in Bridge, you asked the question, what was it exactly that he did that was so bad? So what answer did you come up with?
Well, you know, I didn't come up with an answer that he was so bad, other than the fact that he was an African-American and he took political power at this time. And he held on to it for 20 years, which I don't know of any other mayor in Detroit that was mayor for 20 years. There may have been one, but certainly one in the modern era. And he, you know, he wielded his power. Generally, he did good things, but he indeed did wield his power.
And, Stephen, I know the Free Press last fall did a big, big series digging into the piles of documents analyzing the city's financial history. And just kind of recap for us what the data tells us about Coleman Young's financial stewardship of Detroit during his 20 years in office.
Well, I mean, by any reasonable measure, Coleman Young was a fiscal conservative. I mean, this is somebody who lived within his budget, who understood the value of long-term investment, somebody who was creative about finding revenue and squeezing every dollar and every penny out of every dollar that the city had. You know, a lot of the things that have happened in Detroit over the last 20 years since he was gone would have made Coleman Young blush in terms of the way that we've handled finances, the kind of money we've borrowed, the kind of deals we've agreed to borrow that money. He would never have done those things, and he didn't do those things, the kind of things that we promised to retirees and then did not fund. You know, Coleman Young was very, very cautious about that and making sure to not build long-term liabilities that the city couldn't afford. But of course, the popular narrative is the opposite, that he was the beginning of financial waste in Detroit City Hall, which, of course, you know, as we showed in that series, which was called How Detroit Went Broke, that's just not true.
One can only imagine what he would say about Kwame Kilpatrick's swaps deal.
Yeah, right. I mean, deal alone. Now, what's interesting about that is I think what Coleman Young would have said at that point is, we're bankrupt, and we need to seek the protection of a federal court because we owe $400 million that we don't have. And that really was the other option. And, Kilpatrick came up with what was then thought to be a pretty creative way to avoid that. But there's no way that I think Coleman Young would have signed on to that.
Well, my sense is he wouldn't have gotten to that point.
That's right. We wouldn't have dug the $400 million hole. That's exactly right. Which was, again, that was a pension hole. That was a hole in the pension funds in terms of how much we need to be contributing to make sure that all of the retirees get the money that they have coming to them. We were $400 million short. Coleman Young didn't put us in those kinds of situations.
I'm speaking with Detroit Free Press editorial page editor Stephen Henderson and with writer Larry Gabriel as we explore the legacy of Coleman A. Young. And anyone who was around during Coleman Young's tenure remembers his feisty and very often combative style. Let's take a listen to a typical sample during an interview with ABC News.
To attack Coleman Young, I've become a code word for black. To attack Detroit is to attack black. Politicians run for office by attacking Detroit, by attacking Coleman Young. The media gets headlines.
You're a symbol.
By running bad. Exactly. You got it.
For both of you, was it take no crap black leader what the city needed in the 70s and 80s?
He certainly was appropriate for the times. Okay, I always take an open look at saying that there's not only one thing that we needed or could use, but he was appropriate for the time. He spoke very bluntly at a time when things needed to be said bluntly. And if in that clip that you just played, you know, he told it like it is.
Oh, no, I think he absolutely did. And look at, I think you have to look around to see what that created. I mean, I'm part of a generation of African-American now adults in leadership positions in the city who absolutely owe their positions to his having been mayor, to the way that he insisted that African Americans be let, you know, not just in the door but to the head of the room in terms of managing things around here. I mean, Detroit was a very different place before he was elected for black people. You know, that doesn't mean he didn't make terrible mistakes. It doesn't mean that, you know, at times he adopted that sort of combative stance to the detriment of relations with the suburbs, with the state, in the region. But
you know, a close friend of his has always said to me that what people don't understand when they talk about Coleman Young was that being pro-black was not anti-white for him. It was just pro-black. It was about, you know, let's make sure that everybody is included in the kind of opportunities that exist around here. And somebody like me, you know, I had a close relative who was part of the Coleman Young administration when he was elected in 1973. I think they would all say that you can see the legacy of that all over this town and all over this state.
And I believe that something you just said is still in operation, which is being pro-black is somehow seen as being anti-white. That's still the case.
Yeah.
When you bring up, you know, black is beautiful or something, people automatically think you think white is ugly. And I don't agree with that.
Right.
Well, I think something that struck me in a column, Stephen Henderson, that you wrote at the time of that big piece in the Free Press was asking everyone dial down the emotion from the discussion of Detroit's problems and also come to realistic terms with who Coleman Young really is. How does doing that help as we seek a path back to recovery for Detroit?
Well, I mean, as a student of history, I think, you know, the important thing is always to get it right. That's the first thing you got to do. You can't understand what's going on now. You can't put things in context. You can't chart the framework for the future if what you're relying on is a past that's full of, you know, misinformation and misunderstanding. So, I don't think we can build a proper framework for good leadership in Detroit in the future so long as we are stuck in a narrative that says our past is something that it wasn't. At the same time, we're going to come to terms with the things that Coleman Young did that weren't the best. You know, I think African Americans in the city sometimes tend to gloss over the negative aspects of his administration. You know, I once was considering trying to put together a documentary film about the former mayor, and the working title was Coleman Young, Everybody Has Him Wrong. You know, both supporters and critics, I think, have mythologized this person who was, you know, a person, very human, and had tremendous positive attributes, but also some real foibles that we need to come to terms with. But the reason to come to terms with that, I think, is that truth is power, and truth forms the most powerful narrative you can ever have, and we need that in Detroit going forward.
Larry Gabriel, Bridge Magazine contributing writer, and Stephen Henderson, editorial page editor of the Detroit Free Press. Thank you so much for a great conversation, and thanks for being on Stateside.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yesterday, we checked in on the Kalamazoo River as this week marks 4 years since the Enbridge pipeline oil spill. Today, we look back on one of the most catastrophic man-made environmental disasters ever, the Exxon Valdez oil spill. It was just after midnight, March 24, 1989, when the Exxon Valdez struck a reef in Prince William Sound. 11 million gallons of crude oil gushed into the pristine waters. The cleanup effort was staggering. Among those called to help was U.S. Coast Guard Lieutenant Commander Thomas Haas. He was a chemist and an expert in hazmat cleanup. 25 years later, that lieutenant commander is the president of Grand Valley State University, and he joins us now. Welcome.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
Tell us, how long after the spill was it before you were called to Alaska?
Well, we heard about it, of course, quickly in March, and I was finishing off my semester teaching chemistry and doing some coaching as well. Got a call saying that we needed maybe to get some cadets up here to help with the spill cleanup, basically doing an internship in many regards. But we want you up here because of your background in hazardous materials transportation, and wanted to make sure that we had some people on site that could help the on-scene coordinator.
So tell us what you remember of what you saw when you stepped onto that scene, because that story had been topping the news for weeks. So clearly we'd seen it on the news, but what was the reality like when you got there?
Well, it was really fascinating because they were still trying to figure out with all the different stakeholders, federal, state, the local jurisdictions. We had environmentalists, of course, there. We had the industry, the fishing industry being impacted. And so you had a lot of folks all trying to figure out how to clean this up. And Exxon in particular really wanted to demonstrate, I think, their exercise of good stewardship by trying to clean it up. But we had to figure out what clean meant.
In meaning what?
Well, we had oil, which is I guess you'd basically say it's a mixture of various compounds. All the light ends, that means the gasolines and the like, evaporated, but we were stuck with a lot of goopy mess, and that was hitting beaches and in very, very sensitive area, and these beaches were very, very difficult to get to. So when we got there, we had to figure out what does clean mean and how would you monitor the actual progress on cleaning this particular disaster. And we had to face enormous challenges because of the location.
And there were good faith efforts to clean up, but in retrospect, things perhaps were done that were not good for the environment.
I agree with that. In fact, when we were there, I was entrusted with what was called the job of data manager. I had to do a day-by-day assessment of the various sites upon which we were, quote, trying to clean up, unquote. And I was able to take, at that point in time, some of the infancy with graphic technology to help the on-scene coordinator identify the sites and identify measurements on what clean would be. Well, when we went out to see the reactions of the various and good intentions with Exxon and all, but we were using very, very intrusive means to clean up, basically sterilizing, in fact, some of the beach areas. And that was with hot water spray, hundreds and hundreds of people trying to, quote, clean up. And then we also were faced with the decision on whether or not we used other types of agents to help clean up, too, which were not tested. One area, though, that I thought was quite positive as a result of this was through bioremediation. We were able to do some testing in certain of the beach areas because there are indigenous bacteria will actually consume some of the oils if you treat the area with some basically fertilizers to enable the bacteria to grow and then consume the oil. And we were actually pleased to see some of the results of that particular experiment. But the real efforts to actually, in fact, sterilize the areas with steam and high pressure water and all really was not the best way to go.
So it's interesting when you think of history repeating itself. What lessons do you believe that we did learn from the Exxon Valdez disaster?
Well, I think that one, there's a lot of politics that is involved. Those that believe that they have certain jurisdictions. I do know that after the fact, we had the Oil Pollution Act, which helped with a better understanding of how to ship oil with double hull and the like. So I think we put into place some requirements that help with the safety issues of the environment, also of the workers on board the vessels. But I do think that the lessons learned is that expediency, rushing to do a cleanup may not be the best end long term.
Thomas Haas, president of Grand Valley State University, as a Coast Guard lieutenant commander, he helped in the cleanup of Prince William Sound after the Exxon Valdez spill 25 years ago. Hard to believe it's been 25 years, isn't it?
It really is. It went by in a snap. And what's really fascinating now is my son, who is a lieutenant commander in the Coast Guard, has been stationed up in Alaska twice in his career so far. So we do have a legacy in our family of helping serve Alaska and helping serve our nation. And I'm very proud of him and picking up that part of the responsibilities we have.
Welcome back. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Detroit Blight Removal Task Force recently found 78,506 buildings in the city are decayed or at risk of becoming so. That is 30% of the city's structures. The price tag to demolish blighted homes and commercial buildings in Detroit neighborhoods, $850 million. And clearing out large industrial sites could cost $1 billion more. Alan Brake is here. Alan's recent editorial in the Architects newspaper is questioning the wisdom of Detroit's blight removal plan. Hello, Alan.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we welcome Brian Farkas. Brian's with the City of Detroit Building Authority. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Alan, I want to start with your editorial in the Architects newspaper. The headline is Motoring Toward Destruction with a question mark. What question are you posing in your piece?
Well, I think no one doubts the sort of scale of Detroit's problems. I mean, it's become a real point of fascination for people around the country and around the world, and I certainly don't dispute that there is tremendous challenges facing the city, tremendous amounts of blight, abandoned structures, and these are major issues that need to be addressed. That being said, I think the scale of the blight removal plan is really startling. You know, the numbers that you mentioned at the beginning of the segment are really startling to consider. So without offering any sort of one single solution, I'm trying to just open up the conversation and maybe suggest that demolition alone is not the solution here.
And Brian, what's your thoughts as far as Alan's view that it sounds like he fears Detroit will risk tearing down its identity and really the foundation of whatever Detroit's revival is to be?
I think in the past, Alan probably was correct. There was a huge focus on demolition and demolition alone. In the last 6 months under this mayor, the focus is on bringing families in and doing a kind of comprehensive approach to blight elimination. And in our view, blight elimination doesn't mean demolition. Demolition is one of the tools we have, and quite frankly, it's the last tool that we want to use. We are much more looking forward to moving families into these houses. In fact, the Detroit Land Bank's auction has already raised over $1.2 million by auctioning off previously vacant houses. So our goal is to lean towards auction before demo and rehab before demo.
Well, Alan, I'm going to ask you this both, but I'll start with you. Where do you draw the distinction between what structures should be preserved and really what needs to be torn down?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a hard call to make sometimes. And just to go back to Brian's point, you know, $850 million is the estimate for you know, demolition. How much of that money could be spent on stabilization? You know, whether that's boarding up windows and, you know, buying tar paper for roofs and, you know, maybe sort of mothballing a lot of these structures and setting them aside for eventual use in, you know, 5 years, 10 years down the line, rather than, you know, clearing out, you know, creating more open land and sort of unused space in what is already a very empty city. And beyond that, I would also point out, you know, beyond just stabilizing buildings, you know, what can be done to stabilize the population of people that currently live in Detroit? You know, there's all these reports about people having their water cut off and people losing their homes because of back taxes. And, you know, how much of that money could be used to help people stabilize their lives and stay in their homes rather than lose them and contribute to creating more blight?
Brian Farkas, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, first of all, right now with the emergency manager situation, the mayor is not over the water department. So I really can't get into that, but I do think Alan raises a lot of great points in that we need to make the neighborhood livable. And one of the big, I think, selling points of Detroit is the beauty of the housing stock in a lot of areas and the density of that housing stock. So we actually go through kind of a two-prong analysis when we're looking at houses. And as Alan said, it's kind of on a case-by-case basis of, you know, how do you know when a structure has reached the point of no return with scrapping in Detroit? Once a house is vacant, it ultimately becomes scrapped, and then the cost of rehab ultimately outweighs the economic value of the house. So what we do is we look at the structure of the house itself, the kind of systems in place, the roof, the walls, electrical, But we also look at the neighborhood and the street. Because if a house is in a highly dense neighborhood where a lot of the homes are intact, we're going to lean towards auctioning that house off. We don't want to create the first vacant lot in a neighborhood. Now, that being said, in an area where you have a lot of children playing, if there is a vacant house that continually becomes, the boards become ripped off the windows and it's a, nothing good happens in these houses, if there's no viable option for that house, we will probably demolish it.
I'm speaking with Brian Farkas with the City of Detroit Building Authority, and he's joined by Alan Brake, whose recent editorial in the Architect's newspaper questions some of the wisdom of Detroit's blight removal plan as we look about the big challenge of blight that faces Detroit. I'm wondering, what does it take, will it take, to attract investment and development into these neighborhoods where these buildings are? We've seen all kinds of great things happening downtown and midtown with names like Dan Gilbert and Mike Ilitch and so on. But what about into the neighborhoods where these houses that need to either be adopted through the Detroit Land Bank and get new owners or torn down? What do you do with those neighborhoods?
If I could jump in here and take that one.
Yes.
It's a plan that we're already executing to a lot of success. When Mayor Duggan took office, there was a lot of talk of nobody would move to Detroit or buy these houses. And our auction over the last, I think, 3 months has really proved that there is a market and there's a lot of interest in moving into these neighborhoods. So we're doing the auctions, and again, we've already raised over $1 million by selling off previously vacant city-owned properties. And then we're also scaling it up by doing nuisance abatement lawsuits. So privately owned structures that are vacant, we're going after and we're contacting the property owners saying, you got to do something. This house has to be occupied or we're going to come after you in the court of law. Usually we get default judgments, and then we can auction those houses off. The goal is to move people into Detroit. And I think Alan's article doesn't quite oppose the mayor's views. I think what we're doing at in the City of Detroit, at the Building Authority and the Land Bank, are quite similar to Alan's article.
Mm. What do you think, Alan, based on what you're hearing of how the land bank is working?
Yeah, no, I think the land bank is a great step. I mean, it's something that should have obviously been started a long time ago. I'd be curious to hear from Brian just how many houses and properties have been involved in the land bank so far. What scale are we talking here?
As far as under land bank ownership?
Yeah, I mean, you've quoted this $1.2 million figure, I think. How many properties have been involved to raise that figure?
I think about 70 or 80 have been sold already.
Okay.
And again, we're doing these in the areas that already have stability, so we want to kind of work from positions of strength and target an area and not just do the auctions or do the demolitions, but also we've got a very aggressive plan towards turning the streetlights back on. And so what you're seeing is a kind of a holistic approach to quality of life indicators. We've got neighborhood police officers now that work with residents to address other issues. So we're going after every kind of indicator we can very quickly, knowing it's not going to be an overnight success or happen, within a matter of months, but by kind of systematically addressing the blight, whether it's vacant houses that can have families moved into them, houses that are too far gone that need to be removed, turning on streetlights that haven't worked in years. We're going through and relighting the entire city within a year. Every residential neighborhood will be relit within a year.
Another thing I'd be interested to know more about is, so 70 to 80 houses is a great start. I mean, that's a very important kind of kernel, but obviously at the scale that you're talking about of, nearly 80,000 structures, I mean, that's just a sort of drop in the bucket. One of the things that I think is really interesting about what the Blight Removal Task Force did is they've taken this survey, and there's finally a really comprehensive look at where the structures are, what condition they're in. How much have you opened that out to the public to let the public in on that knowledge and maybe looked for creative ideas beyond just demolish or turn it over to the land bank?
Yeah, the article the technology you're talking about is the Motor City Mapping Project,
yeah.
Which did a survey with Detroit residents, hiring Detroit residents over, I think, a three-month period in the winter. That was kind of a first brush across the entire city indicating or surveying every parcel. Now they've kind of turned it to a public-facing tool where there's a publicly available app. It's called Blexting, which stands for Blight Texting. I know it's available on the Android phone, download for free. I think in a couple weeks they're going to have the Apple version up. But it basically allows the community to now input their thoughts and views on this, because at the Detroit Building Authority, where I work, we're scaling up very quickly to handle the construction operations of rebuilding Detroit. What we need, more important than ever, is the localized intelligence that residents have. And Motor City Mapping enables the residents to very efficiently, very accurately tell us what they think about a building and also if the situation changes. So I know there's been parcel surveys before in the past, but they're kind of snapshots in time that really don't change.
Mm-hmm.
The Motor City Mapping is meant to be a continually updated survey that the residents are the tip of the spear, so to speak, on that.
What do you think of that, Alan?
I think that's tremendous. I think that's exactly the kind of creative thinking that Detroit needs to, you know, come up with solutions, bring in new ideas, and hopefully bring in new people and new investment and, you know, turn things around with some of these, you know, very important buildings.
Let me ask both of you, when you look at decaying buildings and vacant lots and look ahead into Detroit's future, what do you see? Do you see a crushing problem or do you see an opportunity?
I think it's an opportunity. I think when you work in these neighborhoods, you really see the resilience of the neighbors that exist. And one thing that I've been struck by in Detroit is the very strong sense of community. A lot of these residents have had to band together because they haven't had much health, and that leads to incredibly vibrant communities. And so we are here to serve those members of the community.
And Alan?
I agree. I think it's a tremendous opportunity. I think it's something that really could attract investment from people around the country. And I again, just sort of urge Detroit to, you know, move quickly, but also maybe really, really give a chance for that kind of organic growth to happen and for people to reinvest in those communities rather than just clearing lots.
Yeah, one thing I noticed is the article you wrote had the train station as the kind of cover.
Yeah.
Of that, we were excited to see that's privately owned, and the private owner has recently announced he's putting in a freight elevator. I think it's a $2 million investment to assist with the rehabilitation of that structure.
Great. Yeah, I mean, turning that around, I think, would just be tremendous for Detroit's kind of image of itself.
Yeah.
I think everybody who drives by that, sees that, and remembers it from its glory days before it closed in 1988 would say amen to that. Great conversation. We have been talking with Brian Farkas, who's with the City of Detroit Building Authority. And from New York, we were joined by Alan Brake. His recent editorial in the Architects newspaper is headlined Motoring Toward Destruction. Great to talk to both of you. Thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Great. Thank you for having us.
All summer, we've been exploring different ways that we can enjoy our Michigan waters. Of course, there's boating and swimming and fishing. But we've discovered great Michigan snorkeling, scuba diving, even surfing. And now to SUP, stand-up paddling. It's no longer just something they're doing, say, in Hawaii or California. SUP in Michigan is on the rise. Just ask my next guest. Brody Welty is originally from Michigan. Now he's based in San Diego. And as the head of Paddle Fit, he's become a national leader in stand-up paddling. Brody, how did a guy from Corunna become the guy turning the nation on to SUP?
I ask myself that question every single day. You know, I've always had an affinity for the ocean, even though growing up in Michigan, you know, seeing movies, seeing surf magazines, and having a name like Brody, which is not necessarily common. It's more associated with, let's say, California or a surf culture. I was just kind of naturally drawn there. So I, right after college, moved to California. It was kind of my destiny, and then got into surfing, and then as stand-up paddling started to surface, you know, being from Michigan and kayaking and all the water sports, canoeing, all the stuff that you grow up doing, it was kind of a natural fit. And that's essentially what SUP is. It's the combination of surfing, of outrigger canoe paddling, of kayaking, and kind of its you know, hybrid of all these different sports, but yet it's its own sport. So that was kind of my journey of first moving to California and then being exposed to the sport when I eventually moved to Hawaii, and it became part of my job there. So
tough job, Brody, but somebody's got to do it, right?
Exactly.
Tell us exactly what is happening with SUP. What's going on? What do you do?
So, real briefly, the reason why it's taken on and it's grown so fast is because it's accessible. I have a 4-year-old son who I take out paddling. So, if a 4-year-old can do it, and then the oldest person I've ever taken out has been 88. So it's as accessible as kayaking. It's just slightly more difficult than kayaking. So that accessibility is huge. And you look like a place like Michigan that has, you know, 11,000 lakes, and the accessibility. I mean, we're no more than 5-10 minutes from a body of water. Most of us are. So I think that accessibility to water and just that whole cool kind of surf vibe is the attraction to it, but yet it's as simple and as easy that anybody can do it.
Brody, why is it such a good way to enjoy the water and also to get a workout?
Well, the first thing is it kind of just being out in the water, you kind of have to focus on the task at hand. So from a mental standpoint, you can't focus on your job, you can't focus on the kids, you can't focus on your iPhone or Samsung or whatever. You have to focus on paddling. So, you know, studies have shown exercise outside are so much more beneficial from a stress management standpoint. And then just the simple fact of if I had to pick one tool to train people, it would be stand-up paddling, because it is such a complete workout. You're focusing on balance, you're focusing on strength, endurance, and most important, you're having fun. So when you combine all those factors into one, it's just kind of a complete package to get healthy.
What kind of conditions do you need, and what kind of waters? Can I go anywhere?
Yes. The answer is yes. I just came from an event in Idaho where we were on whitewater. So we were going down class 2, 3, 4 rapids on stand-up paddleboards. So that's an extreme. The good thing, like I said earlier, about Michigan having so many lakes is we have calm, flat water in Michigan. So ideally, to learn the sport, you want calm, flat. But you can surf with it, whitewater, anything you can imagine that involves water, you can do stand-up with.
What is a good day out doing stand-up? What's a good sup day like?
So for me or for everybody else?
How about for you?
So for me, I enjoy the surfing aspect of stand-up paddling. So the versatility of stand-up is you can go on flat, calm water. You can go on white water. Well, you can also surf with it. So living in California, we have pretty consistent waves. So to me, I love getting up, hitting the beach, going surfing, and then if I have enough strength afterwards, do a little bit of a distance paddle to get some training and some cardio in.
How about a Michigan SUP experience?
So Michigan SUP experience can have the same. I mean, you said you had surfers on the show before, but ideally, just the natural beauty that we have in Michigan, you know, all the lakes, and I was just at Island Lake, the Metro Park there, and, you know, there, you got a nice little beach, you got these nice green trees everywhere. You know, just being out in nature, and then some of the rivers, and even going up north when you have some of the beautiful lakes like Torch Lake and Lake Charlevoix, you know, just being able to go and access those lakes from a stand-up paddleboard is remarkable.
Is this sport on the rise in Michigan?
Oh, absolutely. I made a post on my Instagram account yesterday saying that Michigan has the potential to have the most amount of stand-up paddlers in the U.S. because of all the access to water. I mean, a lot of times, being in California, we think of stand-up as, you know, surf or race or any of this stuff. But in reality, a place like Michigan that has just as much shoreline as California and Florida, and we have all the inland lakes, I think it has potential to be huge here. In fact, it's on its way to becoming huge.
I love it. Brody Welty, originally from Corunna, now based in San Diego, turning Michigan and the nation on to stand-up paddling, SUP. And you can go to paddlefitpro.com and get more information and get a list of coaches in Michigan. Brody, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Join us tomorrow at this time for a special one-hour documentary from Michigan Radio's State of Opportunity team. We'll see how one school district nearly died twice and what saved it. That's tomorrow at 3. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark, and our engineer was Peg Watson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening.